Good morning, Delaware. It's another great Friday morning here in Delaware. We are delighted to have you with us. It's another good week for the library. We've been busy. We've actually put out seating again after the COVID lockdowns. It's so nice to see people sitting in the library, reading the newspaper, looking at a magazine, using a laptop. Isn't it different?
It's different and it's wonderful. And I love hearing the children. I love hearing the people.
Yes.
It was too eerily quiet and echoey before.
It sure was. It's nice to have some bodies in there. That's Nicole Fowles, our co-host here on Off the Shelf.
Good morning.
And Gage Tellis is working the board.
Good morning.
And our guest today is Kate Quinn, the author of The Rose Code, a new novel that's just come out. Very, very good novel. Just finished reading it this past weekend. Welcome aboard, Kate. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I will do pretty much anything for libraries, not just during quarantine years, but any year, because my mom is a librarian. I was raised running around libraries. They are the most magical places in the world to me.
Can I ask where your mom was a librarian?
In Long Beach, California. She was at the main library at the branch, and so I pretty much grew up running around there.
Yeah. I used to do some consulting for libraries in California, so that's kind of fun to hear that. So.
I think it definitely runs in families. My mother also was an elementary school library specialist, and so I couldn't escape it.
And my mom was a teacher who had finally admitted to me just a few years ago that what she really wanted to do is be a librarian. So,
whether or not we know it, it's in our genes.
I guess it is. It really is. So anyway, it's really delightful to have you here. The Rose Code is set. Well, why should I tell them?
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit, Kate, about what the Rose Code is about?
The Rose Code is the story of three very different women: a tart-tongued London shop girl, a Canadian-born debutante, and a very, very shy and battened-down spinster with a gift for crossword puzzles, who are all recruited to work at the mysterious Bletchley Park, which is an English country house which becomes the hub of code-breaking activity during World War II in Britain. That's it in a nutshell.
You know, that's a great nutshell, but boy, there's a lot to unpack there. I'd like to just start by talking about your three very different protagonists, because they are so individually drawn. There's no confusing them. Even when you don't have, you know, Osla said, Mab said, is it Mab or Mab? I wasn't sure when I was reading. How do you pronounce it in your head when you were writing this?
I pronounced it Mab, like Queen Mab from, you know, Shakespeare.
Oh, I love Queen Mab.
And I was thinking short for Mabel, which was my grandmother's name. So, and so I was thinking Mab. But anyway.
Well, it's her name, too, and she hates that name. So she goes by Mab as soon as she reads a little bit of Shakespeare and realizes she can jettison at least half of the name.
Right. I have to tell you, I love that. When we first meet Mab, she's been reading the 100 greatest novels for to be a literate young woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking of all of the things you see online now that kind of fit into that.
Yeah, it's like her own little personal blog for it.
Exactly. So, but they are so different and so well drawn that they're just incredible individuals. So, I happen to say I really did fall for Mab just because she's the tall one. Beth was a really interesting character because she starts out as this kind of cipher and becomes a fiercely individualistic character. How did you get into her head?
Well, my character Beth, who, you know, really just starts out as a woman who has really no idea that she's ever going to be anything other than, you know, the unmarried daughter living at home, not too much education, not too much of anything in her life, really. And Bletchley Park changes her life because she realizes she has a gift. And she's one of those people with a real gift for seeing patterns and pattern recognition, which is just the kind of mind you need to, you know, in the end, break a supposedly unbreakable Axis military codes. And I really... that was the kind of thing, I did not have that kind of mind. So it was a little bit of a challenge to get into that. And what kind of worldview does that look like? What kind of work is she doing and how it excites her? And I was fortunate enough that, you know, some of the women who worked at Bletchley Park wrote memoirs, and they had some wonderful, you know, deep dive writings about what did it feel like when, you know, you were 3 days into a 5-day binge to try to break a battle plan, you know, before the destroyers are actually going to be setting sail. And, you know, that kind of thing was just invaluable because there's, you know, exhaustion and frustration and yet also a level of excitement to know that your brain is working at this incredible pace, and they're slamming chicory coffee back and, you know, smoking cigarettes and, you know, barely sleeping. And, you know, it was this wonderful thing that I really thought it must have been, you know, in its own way, like a drug. And that's what I, in the end, ended up, you know, sort of using for Beth's scenes and for her worldview, because she does start, you know, when she really gets into this, like she goes down the rabbit hole and just disappears. And I loved writing those scenes for her.
I can imagine, because she just, and she becomes just kind of the key, the focal point of the novel because of what Ozla and Mab go through to help her, most reluctantly at the beginning.
And I always knew that this book was going to be the story of not just code breaking, but a broken friendship.
Yes.
And so, you know, yeah, there are two timelines that are introduced, where in one timeline we see it's, you know, 1940, and these three young women are just meeting each other, you know, from all walks of life, all called to the same place. And, you know, see how they're becoming friends. And yet some years later, in 1947, a few years after the war, you know, these women are very clearly not friends anymore. They have not spoken in years. There is hostility absolutely crackling the air whenever they talk to each other. And you know that something has happened to drive them apart. And yet, on that first page, and this is not a spoiler, it is literally the first page, you know, a coded letter arrives in the mail for two of the three women, and they are being called to put their heads together and come rescue the third, and who was in a very bad way, and who has also is in possession of a very hot secret. And so it's the question of not just can they dust off the old code-breaking skills when necessary, but can they resurrect a friendship that has been really terribly destroyed?
You know, you mentioned the friendship that gets destroyed, and I think part of what's really interesting is there's two inanimate objects in here that feel like real characters. Mm-hmm. One is Bletchley Park itself, the huts, the building, the main building, but also the Official Secrets Act that drives them to such incredible lengths and is actually part of the reason why their friendship falls apart.
Yes, and both of those things really did become very concrete and real to me while I was researching. You know, Bletchley Park in itself really was almost something like a Lewis and Carroll wonderland, you know, that you sort of would fall down the rabbit hole and arrive at this place where, you know, you had all of these people who were working for a common goal, and it was a place where really wonderfully, you know, personal quirks were tolerated and were, you know, it didn't matter, you know, if you were maybe a little bit odd or a little bit, you know, not typical, if you could do the work, you were accepted and you were welcomed. And it was a place where women could have their voices heard, which was, you know, something they may not have been able to find in other places. So that was one thing I really wanted to bring to life, was the park itself, but also the Official Secrets Act, which so much was the lifeblood of the park, because everyone who worked there had to sign an oath saying, you cannot tell anyone, you know, not your husband, not your wife, not your children, not your parents, no one, what you are doing here. And that kind of secrecy led to, you know, strain and paranoia and all kinds of family stresses. And people took it very seriously. I mean, I read, you know, anecdotes about Bletchley Park workers who were so worried that they might, say, disclose information if they were put under, you know, anesthesia, that they would refuse to have a general anesthetic. You know, when they went to the dentist, they would only have a local and have, you know, tremendous pain as they went through it, because they were so worried about what they might say if they were not in control of themselves. And that's how seriously they took it. Wow. And that really struck me as a wonderful thing to be able to illustrate, as well as what is the strain of secrecy like for people who have to live under it for years.
And right? During World War II, apparently nothing leaked from there. Because if it had, the Germans or the Italians or the Japanese would have caught on, and it would have ruined the whole thing, because nobody knew they had the Enigma machine. And so if anything had leaked, that it would have been the next thing that the Luftwaffe would have bombed the blooming hell out of. Nicole,
no, absolutely. You know, the success of Bletchley Park was, you know, hinged on the secrecy. You know, Germany and Italy and Japan could not ever know how effectively Britain was, you know, in essence, reading their mail.
Yeah.
And if they did ever find out, it meant that, you know, as you say, it's like they would have, you know, they would have been bombed into glass, the entire spot. And yet the fact that it never was is, you know, the indication that, you know, this incredible thing that, you know, literally British intelligence hired thousands and thousands of people and then just said, all right, now just don't tell anybody about this, all right? And every single one of those thousands of people just said, oh, okay.
All right.
And they didn't. I mean, that's astonishing to us nowadays when we live in the era of 24-hour news cycles and constant updates on everybody's activities, you know, and the idea that a secret like this could be kept so well.
And then, you know, even some of these people took it to their grave when they were in their 80s and 90s. I mean, the women who wouldn't write about it because they felt they were still under that bond of secrecy. It was just fascinating. I think Nicole has a question she wants to ask. She's been waving at me over here, and I haven't. I'm too excited to talk to you about this.
I'm ready.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Well, I mean, I think it's fascinating, the writing process of especially a historical fiction novel. And I have to ask, when you are researching, is it, you know, a week's worth of research for, you know, an hour's worth of writing? Or what's your ratio? How much time are you giving to your research based and then putting that into, you know, maybe even just a paragraph of the book? How do you divide your time between those two?
Sometimes it does feel like that, a week's worth of research for, you know, a tiny thing. And I'd say this book was the most research heavy I've ever had to do, because not only was there so much written about Bletchley Park once that era of secrecy was over, you know, there were memoirs, there were, you know, technological treatises about the Enigma machines and the Enigma codes. And then there were, you know, there was all the things, since this is a home front novel, about what is it like to live in Britain during this time under rationing during the Blitz? What is the, you know, Bletchley Park itself like, mm-hmm. the social life that, you know, erupts around it, the billeting that people go through? You know, there was so much, and it felt like, you know, at some point the research was just never going to be over.
Right.
I don't think really I ever stopped researching or writing this book. There was, I think, about 6 months and probably more of research before I even really started drafting the first draft.
Wow.
And then there was, you know, research all through it while I was, you know, whatever I needed to learn to get this chapter today finished and written. And then after that, I went on an absolute fact-checking tear, mm-hmm. you know, assisted by a wonderful Bletchley Park independent researcher who I hired because I knew there was so much I could potentially get wrong. And she found so much, bless her, and helped me, you know, sort of wrangle solutions when we didn't know exactly what history was trying to tell us as far as what was correct.
Well, that's fascinating.
So this book was a very hard one to research.
I don't know a lot about the technical side, and some of the cryptography stuff I just kind of skimmed it because I didn't understand all the bobbins and everything. But the slang, you got the slang so well down, because I love, you know, 40s movies and I love one set in Britain and things like that. The slang just, it just felt right. It felt so period. It was just very well done. I mean, I know that's one tiny bit of the research.
Well, that was from the slang I really got from a real misspent youth with lots of BBC, for one thing. And then also a lot of wonderful books that I read that were published in the 20s, 30s, 40s. You know, D.E. Stevenson and P.G. Woodhouse were just absolute godsends. And so, you know, pretty much if they wrote it, you knew it was period appropriate.
Well, that's great. Kate Quinn, I'm so glad we got a chance to talk. I'm really looking forward to talking to you and Martha Hall Kelly on Thursday, April 29th at 7 o'clock for our Friends of the Library. Tickets are available at Eventbrite or through the Friends of the Library website. We were I'm looking forward to hearing you two talk about your novels to each other, mm-hmm. because you've two historical novels, both with really strong, interesting women characters, but set in very different times and different, very different places. So I also love the fact that she wrote about the Civil War, and part of the argument of the book club, the Mad Hatter's book club, is over Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have to side with the people who don't like it. So thank you very much. Kate Quinn, The Rose Code, New York Times bestseller. I noticed on Sunday on the bestseller list. Congratulations. That's a great honor. And we look forward to talking to you again on Thursday the 29th. So thanks for being here.
Thank you again for having me.
We will be right back after this break. We're going to talk a little bit about a little compare and contrast Martha Hall Kelly and Kate Quinn. And we're going to talk about some of the things that are coming up at the library. And I know Nicole has a new book.
I do.
So, all right, we'll be right back. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Boy, that was fun talking to Kate Quinn. She had a lot of good energy there. That's going to be a good talk with her.
I know.
And Martha Hall Kelly on the 29th.
That time just flew by. So if that gives you any indication of what the, you know, conversation is going to be like on the 29th, it's going to be a joy.
I think it will be. And I really want to talk to them both about the fact they both use real people in the books.
Mm-hmm.
So in this one, in The Rose Code, one of the characters is Prince Philip.
Oh, so cool.
Before he got betrothed to Queen Elizabeth and Princess Elizabeth, he was known as something of a playboy.
A little bit.
Just a little bit, you know, not anything too rowdy. But
skosh.
And he's a really good, interesting character in here. Kate Middleton's grandmother worked at Bletchley, and she's a minor character in here. Alan Turing, of course, makes an appearance, but he's not a main character at all. This is sort of like the female version of the Imitation Game.
So yes.
You find out all the other people who worked at Bletchley Park to make it work. So.
And I keep seeing, you know, the, In a Beautiful Mind, you know, he's got all the facts and figures that just kind of sprinkle the air in front of him. That's what I keep envisioning.
Well, I did read that this has been optioned for the movies.
Oh, that'd be great.
And I think it'll make a good movie. Three strong young women characters loose during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be. But I got to find out what these two authors have against mothers.
Uh-oh.
Both books have some of the nastiest mothers.
It's the Disney syndrome.
I think so. You want these people to, well, you know, you basically want these girls that have these mothers to become orphans. Because these mothers are bad little mamas.
They're better off without them.
So anyway, so yeah, Martha Hall Kelly's book, as I noted, is set during the Civil War, The Rose Code during World War II. So it's two very interesting and, I have to say, long, much longer than I usually read in terms of novels. I committed to these two. One's about 500 pages, the other's about 600. And so that's like four mysteries.
You really fell on the sword on this one for me, because I was like, oh man, I'm in the middle of like a nice 250 pager, so I can't quit that.
But now I'm reading Fraud of the Century, the one you told us about.
Yes.
The
Hayes family.
Yes, the Hayes family.
The election.
The 1876 election.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be talking about that either next week or the week after.
Great.
So I'm still listening to the one about the 1948 Cleveland Indians too.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we are just actually now in the middle of the 1947 season when Larry Doby first came up. So anyway.
I really only know about like the 1990s Indians, the Dream Team or whatever they were called.
Still couldn't win a World Series.
No.
Like a nightmare series, but
yeah.
So anyway, what are you reading? I heard when we talked earlier, you're reading something interesting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one. So I think I've mentioned before that I'm in a personal book club, and it's made up of a bunch of neuroscientists who are finishing up their doctorate degrees. They're all like kind of doing their thesis defenses right now, and we vote. We have a very democratic voting system. We do a poll, and your top vote is weighted. And so sometimes the things that we read really lean toward that neuroscience. This one is a really fascinating book. It's called Brain on Fire, and it's written by Susan Cahalan, and it was published in 2012. Netflix. Well, I don't know if it was a Netflix created movie, but there was a movie that was created based on it as well, called Brain on Fire, that was put out in 2016. It's on Netflix right now, and basically the story of Susan Cahalan is that she was a 24-year-old, and she was in her first couple of months or maybe year as a journalist for the New York Post. And she is a little bit stressed, living the New York life. She has a boyfriend. She, you know, is trying to kind of burn the candle on all ends, as, you know, you do when you're a 24-year-old journalist in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And she's starting to have these really terrible things happening to her. Like, she is not sleeping. She has really serious insomnia where she hasn't slept for like a week straight, you know, just 30 minutes here and there. Then her appetite is failing. Then she is developing numbness in the left side of her body.
Ooh.
You know, she just can't really figure out what's going on with her. She's feeling almost a little out of body too. She kind of says to one of her coworkers, like, have you ever felt not like yourself? And, you know, of course, any coworker you say that to is like, honey, every day, you know, like most friends are going to kind of brush that off. You tell a friend, I'm not sleeping. And they say, well, you know, try this, try that.
Yeah.
It's kind of the analogy of you take, you know, 5 neuroscientists and you put them around an elephant blindfolded. And one person is going to say the leg is a different thing. One person is going to say the trunk is a different thing. That's the same thing with what's going on with her. She goes to one doctor and they say, well, maybe this is mono or a virus. Another doctor says, you know, maybe this is something else. It's alcoholism. It's alcohol withdrawal. Because what she learns is that, you know, when you tell a doctor, I maybe drink one or two glasses a night with dinner, they multiply that by 3. And so they're assuming that she's drinking a bottle a day, you know? And so they're like, well, have you been drinking lately? And she's like, no, I haven't been drinking lately because I haven't been sleeping and I don't want to do that. So, you know, the one doctor says it's alcohol withdrawal. And she's like, that's not true. Well, finally, she's in bed one night and she kind of is like grinding her teeth, making like this kind of moany sound. Her boyfriend looks over at her. Her eyes are wide open. And then her arms kind of just shoot out straight in front of her in the air like a zombie. She sits up, starts foaming at the mouth. And he finally realizes that she's having a seizure.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
This is a seizure. And so, you know, biting tongue, everything that goes along with it. He calls 911. They take her to the hospital. And basically, she recounts in Brain on Fire that is basically the last lucid moment that she has for a month. And she kind of loses herself completely after that. The fascinating thing about this book, and I'm not going to give away what the diagnosis is because you should either watch the movie or read the book. The fascinating thing about this book is that what my neuroscientist friends are going to love is the diagnostic process. But what I love about it is her research process, because she actually got her doctor hospital records. She interviewed her friends and family. She interviewed the doctor. She got the EEG, and the EKG and all of the different results. And she actually watched herself on video. And she did all of this to put together this book.
Wow.
To tell the story of this month when she completely lost herself in order for the doctors to find the diagnosis. So, again, I'm not going to tell you what her diagnosis is. You'll have to find that out on your own. However, I also love the original reporting because once she got back on the road to recovery, which she did, and received her diagnosis and all of the things that go along with that, her New York Post editor, as one of her first assignments, said, do you think you'd be willing to write about your experience? And she said, I think I could do that. And so that started her on this journey. So you can also look up on Newsbank, which is one of the great ways to find original sources and original reporting. You can find her article that was published in October 4th of 2009. Her article is a long title. Basically, you know, I was a happy 24-year-old suddenly stricken by paranoia and seizures. Was I going crazy? But you can just look up Susanna Cahalan, or you can even look at our show notes on our podcast, and it'll be linked there as well. But Brain on Fire, it was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. And our book club is going to be discussing it soon. And then we're going to watch the movie and compare and contrast.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds very good. So we've got a few things coming up at the library, too, this week. I noticed on our event schedule, we are doing a virtual teen job fair.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
This is so much fun. We normally would do our teen job fair annually every spring in the library. We invite local employers who hire at, you know, 14, 15, 16 plus, because teens have a very difficult time looking for work. Sometimes just as difficult as adults. Teens also use it to help out their families, help out themselves, save for college. And so what we decided to do this year was we made a Bitmoji classroom. And if you know what that is, then you know. And if not, you need to go click on our website. But what this is it's funny little caricatures of people. It's in a little like kind of PowerPoint looking classroom, and everything is clickable. And so you'll click on different people, and those will take you to links where those are employers who are hiring people who are in their teens.
Oh, cool.
And so if you don't want to have fun with it, if you don't want to click around and find all the things, there is a master link right up at the top that you can that you can bypass all the fun and just get straight to the nitty gritty. But this, I figured, this is going on through May. Our virtual link will be live. And so I figured I could kind of talk about one employer a week. So this week I wanted to highlight, I think it's pronounced Commons Art Shops. And they hire at ages 14 and up.
Wow.
And what they're looking for are people who could potentially be face paint artists or photographers or caricature artists. They will work at the zoo. So this is Commons Art Shops is basically a subcontractor that works through Columbus Zoo. But if you've ever been to the zoo and you walk inside and people are like, hey, do you mind if I take your picture today? Well, it could be a little 14-year-old who just got their first job. So be real nice to them.
Wow, 14. My granddaughter's almost old enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's as long scary. As you can get transportation figured out, right, you can make it work. And yeah. So this is just one of several employers.
Well, that's fantastic. So, yeah, that's going on all the time on our website. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to make a special appointment. If it's, you know, 9:30 at night, you can still jump in there and check it out. So we do have a couple of things that are a little more scheduled coming up this week. We have a new tour of the library's makerspace, which is now known as the Maker Studio. Mm-hmm. That's a registration event that's coming up Tuesday at 6 o'clock. And, of course, on Wednesday is our author visit with Mindy McGinnis. And if you listened to last week's show, you know what a great talk about energy and excitement. That her new book is so good.
Yeah, my coworker Shannon, our teen librarian, and I have decided that we're just going to beg Mindy for the advanced reader copies of the new book. We're like, Mindy, give us the ARCs, please.
And then Thursday, tips and strategies to prepare for the next school year.
Yeah.
Offered with our friends from Huntington Learning Center. That's, again, it's a registered event, so you need to register on our events page. But that's on from 7 to 8 on Thursday, April 22nd. So we have some fun stuff coming up. We have some interesting and educational stuff. And Mindy McGinnis, who could ask for anything more?
I don't know.
I think it's going to be a good week.
Yep. I do want to give a special thanks to everyone who saw our marquee at the Strand Theater this past National Library Week. We did announce our winner. It is Miss Carrie Renee, a Facebook friend of ours. She won our swag bag, and we're just so happy that everyone saw our marquee this week.
It was fun having National Library Week with the marquee up at the Strand. So thanks to our great staff. You make every week like National Library Week. So thank you all for that you do for us. And of course, thanks to the friends of the library who brought cookies for the staff from Cheryl's Cookies for the staff at each of our locations, pre-wrapped. So there was no fingers touching other people's stuff. So it was really nice. A nice gift from the friends. Thank you very much. So Gage, thank you very much for your great hosting.
Absolutely.
Nicole, as always, a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
And we will be back next week. Our guest next week will be Martha Hall Kelly, who's the other half of our Friends of the Library program on April 29th. And we'll be talking about her book, Sunflower Sisters. So make sure you tune in. And in the meantime, we will see you in the stacks.